is instead of having you just email it to us, email will probably be the technique that we'll use for turning in your proposals. But we're trying to figure out how the digital Dropbox works in Blackboard, because that might let us handle in the future larger emailings. Because if all of a sudden I get 20 10 megabyte attachments, it won't bother me too much, but Bob will never be able to read your
reports. One.
And that's what happens when you put graphics and stuff in your reports. In fact, what's funny is this presentation right here that I have, I have it in a Word file just because I use scant graphics. It's a 60 megabyte Word file. You know, Word is normally known for bloated files, but 60 megabytes for a Word file is a little exceptional. But just the scanning stuff. Let me switch the light here, and I'll start talking about today's stuff. This is going to relate to what you're going to be doing, because this is, even though it says senior project, it's really a capstone design course. And the question is, what in the world is design? Oh, I forgot one announcement. Did everyone get my email about the seminar this Wednesday morning? This is the one on patents and intellectual property. I think it's at, what time was it, 10 to 11 or something Wednesday morning? And they'll probably have coffee and donuts. And, you know, students, I know you're always interested in the donut part. But that's over in Nord Hall, third floor, in the conference rooms. That's actually a topic that's very relevant to this course, because in about 2 weeks, we'll have our vice president come in and talk about patents and intellectual property. And when it comes down to it, engineers basically create two things. Most of you think, at least the ones that you put co-op, you suspect that the only thing engineers produce is paperwork. Well, that is wrong. Paperwork is okay, but it's not valuable to anyone. On the other hand, what is valuable, which the companies can sell, are products and intellectual property. Products, you have a pretty good idea of what it is. You know, that can be anything like a cell phone, a computer, what many of your senior projects are going to be. But another thing, which it can be, is intellectual property. You don't necessarily have to manufacture them, but other companies will want the license to either do it the way you've developed or to prevent anyone else from doing it your way. And this is stuff that's bought and sold among companies. And you can get all kinds of corporate strategies. We're not going to do that in this course. That's more in an entrepreneurship course. But go to that seminar, and it'll probably help you write your patent disclosure that we'll do later on in the course. Okay? Now, what I want to talk about today is design. What is it? We're going to talk about the design cycle. We're going to talk about some examples of design and tools for doing design. Okay? One of the big things that students have a lot of problems with is recognizing design. And this is the Webster definition. It really doesn't help you that much. Notice it's the arrangement of parts, detail, form, color to perform an artistic or skillful invention. We, as engineers, tend to be more on the skillful invention side. You know, changing the colors or doing stuff like that isn't necessarily something that we think of. On the other hand, if you go to our colleagues down the street, the Cleveland Institute of Art, they have excellent programs in industrial design. They design toys. Lots of times, the distinction between toys is not whether it has a different pedal in it, But what does the pedal cart look like? On the other hand, an artistic and skillful invention, the iPod.
Great job. Although, the best thing is really the digital rights management and the music marketing behind it. That's why Apple stock has gone up probably 300 to 400% since they started doing that. Okay?
Now, we're going to first of all talk about the process. Let me ask a question.
I think it must have been about 2 weeks ago, I told you that your assignment was to read Chapter 2 of Hornstein, which was one of the references on our webpage. I'm not going to base any grading on it or anything. Did anyone here actually read it? Yeah, you read the first half. Wow! Okay, one person in the class.
Okay, because I'm going to be basically telling you stuff that is in Hornstein. You can find this in almost any other reference about design. But Hornstein has some very specific examples in it. An engineering design competition, which I'm going to tell you about. It's actually something we could do, but we're not. But here is a good overview of design in terms of engineering. Analysis is what many of you confuse design with. Analysis is doing the homework problems in most of your courses. Okay? Now, some of those might be design problems, but we'll get to that. Okay? But if all you're doing is mathematical analysis, a homework problem, that's not design. Okay? Now, this actually is questionable. Reproduction, recreating something, this actually goes on a lot in industry under the guise of design. This is called reverse engineering. It is especially common in software. And we were just talking today. We're probably going to have someone come in and talk specifically about software design, because that seems to be an area that almost everyone in this class is deficient in. I think we had one person take 398. Okay. So, but we'll talk more about that, but that's something that also ties in with copyrights and intellectual property. Okay? Now, here's what we're really into. Creation, this is design. Creation of a product or device to meet a need or spec. Okay? Key thing there for most of you is a specification. There should also be something else here which says that there's not one way to do it. There is not a single, necessarily, best answer. In fact, that's part of your job as engineers. You're going to be telling your management, your boss, this is the best way to do it, and why. That's how you earn your keep, okay? But this right here, notice, this is very oriented towards a product. Not all of you are building something. A number of you are going to be designing simulations. You're doing stuff which is actually even closer to the research side. This is especially true in systems engineering. Okay? But you can be designing a computer simulation to meet a need or a specification. And by the way, what can the specification be for a computer simulation? It could be. Sometimes it's common sense stuff. And this is a very, very big thing. You know, for example, if you have some computer model that's estimating lifetimes of individuals based upon public health programs or something. If you stop and think about it, you probably should have a very large number of people at age zero.
in other words, babies. Your population should be monotonically decreasing. That would be a specification. And the other thing is, beyond 200, there better be zero. In other words, if you're more than 200 years old, I would be rather surprised. You know, those are common sense things, but they are specifications. And you would think of doing things like that to verify your model. Another thing would be is if you have published data from another study that's done it a different way, if you have known points at which they must correspond, that corresponds to a spec. So even though today I'm going to be talking a lot about hard products. Now, this is an example straight out of Hornstein. You're going to build a catapult, which is going to be sending something, I don't know, maybe pumpkins. Anyone here follow the pumpkin catapult contests? They're pretty interesting. If I can find a DVD of them, maybe I'll bring one in. That would have been a fun little thing. But there's two real big differences in analysis and design. Analysis here is, I've got the catapult. What I have to do is figure out how much force, the pointing direction, stuff like that, so that I can hit a specific target. That's analysis. What's design? Design is primarily building the catapult or telling someone how to build it. Now that's a fairly obvious one, but some of you are going to be in positions where the distinction between analysis and design is going to be pretty hazy. Now, boy, this one actually works. The printout came out with all black rectangles. Good design versus bad design. And some of these are very obvious, okay? Good design works all the time. Bad design, it stops working, like a cheap computer that you picked up. Bad electrical contacts, whatever. Bad design. Actually, it could even be bad manufacturing. The design could be good, but someone put a bad component in. But you want reliability as one of your major things. Good design versus bad design. If someone put a set of technical requirements on your product, your senior project, whatever, obviously the design that meets them all is better than the one that only meets part of them. Okay? Now, this is more important in industry, where we're getting now. Typically, these are actually, to be honest, for this course, we tend to primarily focus on item two. Okay, the third one, cost. If you're a company, you want it to be really, really cheap. Now, software, the manufacturing cost is really, really cheap. You know, you just get a CD duplicator or a DVD duplicator, and you print boxes. Okay, on the other hand, if you're in the automobile business, those tend to be very expensive to make. Cost is a very big deal there. So this is more important in certain domains than others. Most of your projects tend to be on the cheap side. I think the largest budget I've ever had for a senior project was $250,000. A person automated an entire plant. Eighth of a million was actually for the radiation source that would measure the thickness of a piece of steel going through the plant. But that was a while back. Most of yours, though, tend to be on the order of like $0 to $100. If you're tied in with a research program, you'll have a little more budget. Now, here's an interesting one, which we don't really pay much attention to. Little or no maintenance, frequent maintenance. An industry that was plagued by this was the automotive industry. And I refer to Detroit versus Japan. American cars were known as terrible for the longest time. And that goes with computers, with all kinds of things. You want to buy it?
That is, the customer wants to buy it, and it works, and works reliably. Now, this is a good one. Safety. Now, for your one-of-a-kind projects in here, now, we've actually had a couple projects which have turned out to be products. I had one student a number of years ago. By the way, our total budget for his project was $90. We bought a camera with a serial interface back when cameras were expensive. That was the whole budget. We set it up and developed computer software that if you put the camera above a door, it would look at the area in front and count the people that were moving. And what it was, how many of you have been to Radio Shack and, you know, you've gone through the light beam? This would do it over an area. Okay, so it would count people. And the idea is to sell it to businessmen and mall owners. That way they can put it front of their stores and their shopping malls, count how many people actually are passing by, come in, get population density, and by the way, charge that business according to how many people are there. A new rent model. And this actually now has installations, I think, on 3 continents. So it turned into a pretty good senior project. Lost some train of thought there. Okay. But that was an excellent little project, little budget, but it turned into a product. And that's where, you know, that's where these issues of maintenance and safety come in. That one has no safety issues, unless the camera falls down and hits someone. That's not a major thing. However, maintenance is a big issue because you have to adjust it turns out, to lighting. Things are very, very sensitive to lighting. Finally, ethical dilemma. You don't usually think about this, but for example, in our catapult, this is a simple one. We have people that have moral or ethical objections to designing weapons. There are all kinds of other things, particularly in the medical field. And we've even had, and we'll talk about this later with ethics, issues of vehicles which are unsafe as designed. Parts fall off. Not a very good thing, particularly if it's like an airplane. And there are known situations of this. So, those are some of the big things, and we've just really gone through all of these, so I'm not going to say anything more there. Now, I don't know if you've had any discussion of the design cycle before. This is what you're actually doing in this course. This is sort of the big picture. It starts out in a straight line, and then it goes into what we call, the loop. And the only way to get out of it is to meet your design specifications. This applies to software. This applies to hardware. It applies to computer simulations. It's everything. You're up here right now. Your proposal is primarily concentrating on the first two and maybe the third. What are the objectives of your project? That's actually what your concept statement was that you handed in, and we gave you feedback on. I think I may have one in the queue that I haven't responded to yet. Okay, but this is where you're coming up with your specifications. This is where you're figuring out what you're going to do. Now, this is a very important one here. Choose a design strategy. This is one that everyone skips over. You know, you don't normally sit back and say, okay, let's figure out how we're going to do this. Most of the time, you just jump in and start doing it. Okay? That's usually bad. And we're going to talk about some techniques for design strategies, design alternatives. It turns out the more you do early, the better. Remember the example I said earlier about my student that designed the CAD software that cut a couple weeks off of the design cycle. Anytime you can cut time out of this loop, it's great. And the more you can put up here, usually stuff up here is fairly short. This is where you can get stuck. But let's talk about the next step.
You have your project. You have your proposal. What you're probably going to do is start doing research. First thing you'll probably do is go on Google. That's what everyone does. For those of you that are doing electronics, by the way, and stuff like that, and this is something I don't even know that Larry Sears knows, there is a Google for electronics applications notes. It indexes part specifications. You want to know about 2N2222. You type that in on that page and you come back with a spec sheet for it. You'd also come back with applications notes, stuff that uses it, etc. I have this, by the way, listed in the engineering resources section of the course webpage. But there are specialized Googles that can be useful for engineers. Okay. Some of you are not going to be able to get anything useful out of Google. The systems engineering students, you know, they're a little closer to simulation, etc. They may have to go to the IEEE database or some of the other databases and get some scholarly publications or even government reports. You know, Google is a great thing, but there's a lot of stuff that isn't in it. So you need to collect as much information as you can. This now is where you start doing your first cut at the design. At this point, what you can do is, it might be you're going to use a certain motor or a certain bearing or maybe a different kind of material, even a software package. You know, that's what you've been collecting all the information about. When you start making these decisions, that's when you're really starting to design. You're saying, this is better than that for a particular reason. Sometimes the reason is, we have it, therefore it's free. Cost is a consideration. Now here's where the real design that we normally think of comes in. Build a prototype. Now that can mean building a circuit. That can mean building a car or a plane. It can also mean writing your first piece of code. Doesn't have to be hardware. This can be where you write your prototype program, your code fragment, whatever. Now, here's the part that most of you don't do. Document. Hardly anyone does this. This is where you're supposed to pull out your lab notebook and scribble something down. Unfortunately, well, I'll get to software in a moment. People that are building things like space shuttles or, you know, hypersonic vehicles or something find it easier to do this loop than software engineers. And there's a reason why. We'll get to it in a moment. You document what you did, whether it be code or hardware. You test it. If it's code, it's real easy. If it's hardware, it may be specialized. Does it meet your spec? Does it do what you want it to do? Okay? And if it doesn't, and usually this really means all your specs, okay, then you revise, add, modify, and then go through the whole cycle. Where software drives this nuts, this model nuts, is if you change one line of code, technically you're going through the cycle. The big problem with software is you're going through so many design changes so rapidly that you can't keep up with the documentation, and so the standard response is you don't do any. And we'll talk about that. But software is a very, very fast loop, and that's the problem. And then finally, you test it. This is where you want to be for your final report, the final week of the semester. Now, we're going to use the example out of Hornstein. And it's an interesting one. It's a product one. It's actually oriented very much along the lines of things like the egg drop competition.
you know, these engineering week activities. Do you ever wonder why they came up with some of them? You know, some of them where you build bridges. This is a competition that was done, I think, at Virginia Tech, where Hornstein is at. And the idea is, and it probably makes more sense if I just skip forward and show you this. It's an engineering competition. You build a little wheeled vehicle. It's got a possibility of a couple different energy sources. And the idea is you have two teams. Whoops. One there, one here. They launch their vehicles at the same time, and they run up the top of the hill. And the idea is the person, or rather the team, which is on top of the hill, when the timer shows that 15 seconds has elapsed, is the winner. I picked this one to be different, especially than the egg drop one. Okay? But the key thing is, and this is the way engineers think, usually engineers love to put numbers on stuff. Physicists are somewhat the same way. They like to do that. You notice it says, here's how high it is. The top is 30 centimeters. You've got ramps of 150 centimeters. By the way, this will be covered with carpet. It will be 30 centimeters wide. And the idea of the competition is both of these vehicles take off at the same time. The maximum size of the vehicle is 30 centimeters long. Notice, that's 30 centimeters wide, and the idea is whichever one is on top at the end of that 15 seconds wins. Okay, this will make reading the chapter one heck of a lot easier. You've got a whole, this is the big picture. This, by the way, is probably similar to an executive summary type thing. Gives you a big picture of the competition. Tells you you've got the ramp and you're supposed to sustain your position. Gives you some dimensions, and then it gives a definition down here. If you have strings, extensions, like a harpoon or a ramp or anything, or if you shoot anything at the other vehicle or drop stuff off, it's all got to be within those two lines. And they define the lines as being there and there. So you have to be sitting up there, and you can have strings, wires, spears, whatever, sticking out, but they can't exceed those. Okay, there's a lot of detailed specs. You can read all of this. I'll just point out a couple here. But this is how you could make an interesting Engineering Week competition. If any of you are organizing Engineering Week, maybe you should suggest this one. Must be autonomous. Can be no bigger than a third. Basically, this is still pretty big. 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters. That's an awful big vehicle. It tells you how it starts, how it can be powered. Batteries, rubber bands, or mouse traps. You're free to choose which one. That's an engineering decision. It can't be any bigger than 2 kilograms. No chemicals or dangerous substances. And here is something interesting from the viewpoint of that ethics and risk analysis and stuff that we talked about earlier. There's an environmental consideration. Mercury switches. These are tilt switches that detect, for example, if you're horizontal or vertical. They contain a glob of mercury in them. Very, very hazardous if that would break during a competition. They have to call in the Cleveland Fire Squad. They have all kinds of hazardous vehicles would show up. You know, it would be really interesting, but not a very smart thing to do and very, very expensive. And then there's some more stuff. And it's the best of six, so there's some statistics. And I'm not going to go through all the details because you can read this. But if I hadn't explained the competition to you, you probably would have gotten bored trying to figure out what it was from the book. Okay? And they make a big deal showing different parts of the design process. They really get carried away. I don't expect you guys to, and gals, to write a decision tree. Okay, showing, okay, if I pick batteries, here's how I start it, stop it, and here's how I convert the electrical to mechanical. I mean, I have to turn wheels if I've agreed that it's got to have wheels. So you've got energy conversion. Rubber bands, even big choices. Do I twist them or do I wrap them around something? Circumferential, torsional. The mouse trap is one of the more interesting ones. Mouse traps have a pretty powerful little spring there. But there are all kinds of little issues. Spring runs out fast. It's a very quick thing, a very short thing. Not a mouse trap's not very applicable to fine control. It tends to go bang. That's pretty much it. And remember, one of the things that you have to do in the competition is stop at the top. Figuring out that you're there and stopping at the right place is a big deal. And I'll go through this part fast because we want to do a whole lot of other things. There's all kinds of choices that come in. Front wheel drive versus rear wheel drive. And one of the ideas was they came up with a wedge because obviously it's going to go under the opponent's vehicle and maybe flip off. Okay, do you apply front wheel or rear wheel? This is very interesting. If you've got rear wheel drive turning in that direction, your overall force vehicle, just like, you know, airflow, aerodynamics of vehicles forcing them down at high speed, same thing here. If you put the drive up front, you end up with a net torque going around like this, and your vehicle might flip if it got under the opponent's vehicle. These are subtle little things. You wouldn't have thought about them, and they're not great engineering calculations. This is simple sketches. But it's great engineering. Here's a sort of a better design or better picture of what they came up with. A wedge, two wheels. They've got a 9-volt battery, a motor with a chain, and a switch here to turn it on and off. There's all kinds of other aspects of it, which we're not going to cover, like how big are the wheels, how far apart do you put the wheels, because you have to go up and then become horizontal. And if you're coming really fast, and depending upon the diameter and spacing of the wheels, you hit that hump right there and you're going to go flying off over here. You know, there's some finesse in this. You can control the wheelbase, wheels. Lots of design decisions. You have to consider weight distribution. If you burrow under the other opponent's vehicle to try and throw it off, if you have your rear end sticking out here and you get a weight on it, it's going to tend to flip you backwards. There's all kinds of stuff. There's even a strategy of how aggressive you want to be. How many people took 375, the Lego course? This starts to sound familiar, doesn't it? A lot of that kind of thinking. Now, here's something you get big points for. This is good engineering. By the way, I did point out that the battery source are 9-volt batteries. Okay? It turns out you'll never go out and buy a 9-volt battery. There is no such beast. They're all 6-volt batteries and 12-volt batteries. But that's another story. Even though it shows it running directly off of the 9-volt. But you buy a cheap one at Radio Shack, I've got news for you. You probably don't get any specifications with it. You get a motor. And it probably cost you $4, way overpriced, and no specs. So what's a good engineer do? You measure the motor torque versus the applied voltage, or current, more specifically, if you do DC motors. Okay? And this is just some really nice engineering. Here's four motors. And you put a string around the shaft and see how many weights you can lift up. That's good engineering. Didn't require a lot to do other than good thinking. Now, some of the tools. The fun one we're going to do at the end, you may not agree that it's fun, is going to be brainstorming. Okay? But all of these others are important. Teamwork, we've been talking about. So number one's off the list. Project management, we talked about the last time. Project management's a really important thing to make sure that you can get out of your loop. And one of your specs, even though many times it's implied, is that the project be done at a certain date. That actually is a spec. You tend to forget it. I told you earlier, we're not going to say too much about reverse engineering. But if I can have someone come in and talk about software engineering, we're going to say more about reverse engineering, because that's especially where reverse engineering is found. So, brainstorming. Brainstorming can be as simple as two of you, sometimes even one of you, but brainstorming implies that there's a group, a team. Okay? You don't have to be sitting, standing. You can be doing all kinds of activities. These are often done in very informal settings. I said earlier that this could often be done with a keg of beer. That's quite common. But the idea is to come up with all possible ideas, no matter how stupid, how dumb, how expensive, how ridiculous. The idea is to have lots of ideas. And then you can look at them and figure out what's good and what's bad. Don't feel embarrassed. And by the way, we're going to have an exercise where you come up with stupid ideas. Hopefully, we'll weed them all out. But, okay. But this is the key thing. The more ideas, the better. Now, believe it or not, people, psychologists, and actually industrial engineers are really, really big into this. If you get into optimization, the system side of the house really, at times, starts to act like psychologists. But here's a way to generate a whole lot of ideas. This is a formal one. Okay? This is called the idea trigger method. People publish papers on this. Okay? It's not the kind of engineering we normally do. Okay? The first one's called the purge phase. Okay? But here's really what you do. And I'm going to show you a form, and you'll use to do this. But for 2 minutes, all you do is write down every dumb idea that you can think of to solve a particular problem. Okay? Then for 30 seconds, you take a break. This is, the psychologists are into this. How many of you are doing a psychology minor? There's usually a couple in here. Whoa. None? How many of you are going into engineering management? You really should start considering psychology. I would recommend Child and Abnormal. Those work quite, those are very applicable.
Nobody wants to manage. They just wanted to.
Hey, I took my minor in industrial psychology. At that time, we had a program in industrial psychology. But we'll talk about that in another time. But anyway, you work for 2 minutes, you take a 30-second break, and then you work furiously for another 60 seconds writing down more ideas. Okay? So that's, the concept's really simple, right? And maybe you can use this as a formal technique for doing some of the applied circuit design solutions. Although Larry would poo-poo anything that's too formal. Okay. Anyway, what you do is, once everyone on the team does this, you do it all in parallel, no talking. Now you talk. And let's suppose, this looks like a good group of three. Okay, suppose there's three people. What happens is one person starts and then just reads all of their ideas. While he or she's reading his ideas, I guess it's a he, while you're reading your ideas, if any of their ideas are the same as yours, they just cross them off their list. Then we move on. You'll come up with now all of your unique ideas. The idea is
you're weeding out and coming up with only unique ideas. While this is going on, you can be writing in column two any ideas that were stimulated by hearing the other people's ideas. You know, it might be that someone came up with the idea that you put a ram at the front of your vehicle and that piqued competition. You know, it could be that with the idea of a mouse trap or a rubber band there, you get the idea, let's catapult a weight on top of them. Or better yet, let's use fish hooks or, you know, battering rams or something. You know, you can get destructive in this. Okay. But that's the second phase. The next phase is you do the whole thing over again. Having heard everyone, you sit down, you do 2 minutes, your 30-second rest, and your 1 minute. And usually, doing it twice is enough to come up with tons of good ideas. And this is what a form looks like. In fact, I'm going to give you some of these. We're going to do an example. And this might be for that competition, and you'd never have it typed up. The idea is you just scribble stuff down fast. And you might, you know, this might be the first one. You're going to make a frame out of wood. You're going to use the wrecker set components to screw it together, although super glue might be easier. That would be something to put over here if you just got the idea. Zinc air batteries. Why zinc air? I have no idea. That's expensive. Rubber band. Small car. Okay. After you think about it, you're going to ram the opponent. After 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you've decided to become aggressive. And you're going to use a wedge-shaped body to flip it up and over. Okay. And now, you listen to everyone else's ideas. You come up with more new ideas. You've decided you're going to really get more and more aggressive. You're going to throw stuff at the opponent. Okay? And this actually is a very good idea, which if you read the book, is really cool. A threaded shaft. And this gets into how do you start and stop the vehicle. I'm going to come back to that. We're going to do a couple examples. But I just want to finish up a couple little things. These days, everything's electronic, except your lab notebook. You notice I keep pushing the lab notebook. Very, very good thing. A 50-cent to a dollar lab notebook is great. That's all you need. But believe it or not, this lab notebook is a bigger deal. I mean, they actually sell really, really high-quality archival lab notebooks, you know, low acid paper. They're bound. They're sewn together. Okay. The page, that's permanently bound. Pages are numbered so that you can go through and detect if any pages were ripped out. Okay. Because this is a legal thing. This stuff is usually not legal. Although sometime I'll tell you about how you deal with software in lawsuits. But ink, don't use whiteout, by the way. Don't use pencil. Don't use anything which is not permanent. You can cross out mistakes. You can be sloppy. Don't bother with recording opinions. Data. That's what your lab notebook's for. Just tons and tons of data. Now, you can put ideas and stuff in, but be very careful because your boss might read. If you do one for this course, which I highly encourage, I might read it. And by the way, if you do a good lab notebook, I'll usually be inclined to move your grade up. That's a good motivation. Put all kinds of data in there. Date it. Okay? And by the way, we're going to put this on the website, just like everything else. Don't leave blank pages. If for no other reason, it's a waste of paper. But it looks like you might have erased somehow something. You know, with a bound notebook, I couldn't figure out how, but don't. You never know. Attorneys get very upset. Put stuff in your notebook. In essence, your notebook is nothing more than a filing cabinet for stuff. Now, I mean, if you've got a huge printout or something, you're not going to put that in. But you glue all kinds of stuff in it, staple. That part's not as critical. But since that stuff can come out, at least label what you put in it so that you can tell 10 years later or whatever. These are some examples of notebooks. I'll be honest. My stuff doesn't look that good. That is really, really nice. But this is very common. Engineers love to use quad rule paper because it gives you lines to draw stuff on. You can plot graphs. You can do all kinds of stuff. Okay, here's a graphical design. Here's just putting down some data on the power requirements for that little vehicle. And it's just saying, here's what I'm doing. That's it. Here's that motor characterization. All kinds of stuff. One thing that you could put in your notebook, and I highly recommend, contact information. You know, if you had a meeting with someone, get the phone number or email. Put it all in your notebook. You're going to lose business cards. You know, this is more important as you get out and work for real companies. You know, here, you're not so much worried about business cards. Although, what's a very, very smart thing to do, which is very professional, when you interview, it's actually very cool to pull out a business card and give it to the interviewer. You never know where you're going to run into someone. You know, it could be at a digital mixer or some kind of networking event, but you can pull out your little card, you know, says Frank Merritt or whatever, engineer for hire, and contact information. Actually, you want to put something like world's best electrical engineer or something. Believe it or not, some guy at one of those events gave me a card that said that. World's best engineer. I thought the claim was dubious, but it's the way things work. So, and you can get business cards for your inkjet printer or your laserjet printer. They're inexpensive. Just print them out and take them with you. You look very professional. It's called marketing. Absolutely. And we'll have Steve Belovich come in to talk about marketing later. Some comments on software documentation. This is the thing that you do the worst in the entire course. That fast cycle is what usually messes things up. You really should document your code by something. It can be a software requirements document. You can do pseudocode. You can do flowcharts. I don't know if anyone does flowcharts anymore. But whatever you want. But there should be something, and that can go into your lab notebook. Just a few things before we do our brain busting exercise. This fits in with what I said earlier, you know, where you're developing some simple things for determining how your software program, for example, should work at certain conditions. There seems to be an aversion to doing really simple calculations. You don't need MATLAB. You don't need Simulink. You don't need Mathematica. I mean, Ohm's law, you know, V equals I times R, I can do that with a calculator. Pretty simple thing. You can do simple calculations, as they point out. How much energy does it take to get from a position down here to a position on top of that hill? You can do that just by very simple, one half mgh type calculations, that sort of thing. Put in an efficiency of maybe 50% for the electromechanical conversion. Do some very simple calculations. Don't get tied up in programming. Don't get tied up in all of this. In the old days, this was called back of the envelope calculation. The idea was that the complete analysis should fit on the back of a little envelope. You weren't allowed to fit computer programs, simulations, differential equations, or much of anything on it. If it took more than about 20 lines, it was too long. Simple stuff. So do some feasibility calculations. Prototyping breadboarding.
Prototyping applies to everything, especially software. Anytime you write a piece of software, that's a prototype. Breadboarding, like for example, the folks in any, who's it?
It's the group that's doing the superconducting barium in here.
Oh, okay. For example, you might want to actually build something out of some material, a barium, put it in liquid helium, and see if it falls apart under stress. That's a good example of breadboarding and prototyping. The breadboarding tends to be more physical. Like for Larry Sears, you build a circuit. That's breadboarding. It doesn't have to be physical. If it's non-physical, we tend to think of it as prototyping. The reverse engineering we'll talk about later. Now, we're going to do some brainstorming exercises. I have 6 problems here. And we're going to split up and work on them. Come up with an idea for a system that will allow a truck driver to check the air pressure of the tire without getting out of the cab. Coming up with an alarm system to prevent someone from stealing memory chips out of the computers in Glennon 308. That was a big deal. Still is. You may have noticed there's all kinds of locks and stuff. Here's a good one. This could be a real GE or TRW or Allen Bradley thing. How do you make all the screws that are coming out of a screw-making machine line up? These are standard wood screws or machine screws. They have a head and a long threaded. Right. Okay. Here's a good one. Develop a system that automatically raises and lowers the flag on a flagpole at dusk and dawn. And by the way, do it the proper way. It goes down at dusk and comes up at dawn. Okay? I don't want a 180-degree phase reversal there. Okay? Here's a good one. A system that will automatically turn on a car's windshield wipers when needed. Now, these are more product. I should have put a software one in here. Here's one that fits in with that race. Come up with a way to stop the car at the top. This is a control problem, actually. It's actually a sensor problem. You've got this little vehicle tearing up, gets up there on top. How do you know when it's supposed to stop? There's all kinds of ways of doing it. So what I am thinking of doing, and we'll see, I think the organization is not too bad. We're going to organize groups. I'm just going to assign you to projects. We're going to do these. I'll have one or two teams read off their results. We'll go to the next step, and that'll be it for today. So how about, let's see, there's 4 of you down here. You guys are going to do problem 1. Do you like my great organization here? Okay. Let's see. Yeah, we'll just go straight down the road. This team, you're doing problem 2. Let's see. 6. These 2 rows are doing problem 3. Idea. There's no talking. Don't worry. You have 2 minutes beginning now to come up with any solution you can come up with for your assigned problem. Hiring an outside consultant, by the way, is not an acceptable solution.
People will put those things down. But come up with anything, no matter how crazy it is, how financially unfeasible it is. And don't worry, you're not going to get graded on how bad your ideas are or how many. Okay, 2 minutes are up. So just stop writing, you know, goof off for 30 seconds. You ought to be very efficient at that part. Don't do anything for 30 seconds. Don't think for 30 seconds. You know, turn your brain off. Yeah, I know, this is the easy part of the course. Okay, turning your brain off is easy. Okay, put it back in gear now. 60 seconds. Okay, the 60 seconds are up. Bob, pick a number between 1 and 6. 4. Where's team 4? Who's working on crowd? Oh, who's the flagpole team? Okay. Stand up and just start reading off your column 1 ideas.
The electrical relay on top to signal the flag is raised, and the same on the bottom, so it can stop and stop raising and stop lowering when it reaches the top of the bottom. Either an electric eye to look at the change in lighting conditions to signal that the sun has come up, and start raising the flag, and the same on the bottom to see when the sun has set.
Don't forget, the rest of the team is supposed to be looking at their ideas.
Yes.
Okay.
Or is it converse at bottom?
No, sure.
And then, or a computer-controlled based database that would just control raising or lowering of the flag.
Okay. Additional ideas.
Wheel drive, photo resistor, clock, radio clock with 2 alarms. And flag gets stuffed into the slot in the tube with that clock.
Nice touch.
A simple timer as a
Now, did any of you come up with any additional ideas on hearing those ideas? No additional ideas? No.
Use a lighter view all around our PC.
Yeah, PC is awful expensive.
Hire some kids to do it for
you. Okay. We'll do one more example. Okay. Team one down here. Okay. And by the way, I've worked on this problem for 10 years, and other people here have also. But go ahead. So, how would you measure a truck tire pressure?
You have a pressure sensor in the tire, a water pump to the cab. You have a ride height sensor, or an acoustic sensor for when the tire sound changes and starts going flat. Air volume sensors, pressure cap on the wheel with a small CCD camera, or a ground to axle distance sensor as the tire starts to flip. Where you have capacitive measurement inside of the tire to tell the temperature.
Okay, pretty good.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Okay, that's fine.
I guess one thing different is that you can estimate the pressure from the profile of some kind of camera.
Okay.
And some kind of put a bend sensor in there, and when you make the tire, what they do for how it's going to.
Okay.
I have a speaker transmit an impulse at the tire, and then look at the resonance or the impulse response. Have a distance to ground sensor on the upright carrier, plus a load cell on the actual axle, so that you know how much force is pushing the tire towards ground. And then RF powered pressure transducer, so basically, you know, something on board, use a coil type, some antenna to send power to the sensor and receive data back. And I just thought of one other thing.
He's getting into column two. Okay.
Are we ready for that?
No, go ahead. You'll be the first column two.
Okay. You might could use something like a piezo-resistor material in the actual belting of the tire itself, and look at how much strain you're putting on that.
Although the tire flexes considerably as it rolls along.
Right. Well, you'd have to be able to accommodate for that.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity, you said you spent many years looking at that problem. Is it for a particular company?
Can't tell you that. I have a non-disclosure agreement. However, I can tell you what people are doing. And for example, Professor Koh here did a very nice project for DARPA back about 8 years ago, where they actually embedded a MEMS pressure sensor with a passive RF, a telemetry type readout, in the tire. This is a major achievement. Why? Because have you ever thought about what goes into how you make a tire and putting electronics inside the tire that will remain functional after you make it?
Could you design that actually?
Yeah. But 10 years ago? Yeah, Koh did all of the original work here, which was somewhat interesting. What was the common technique that everyone was doing, and there's tons of patents, by the way, in this one, the valve stem. You put a pressure sensor on the valve stem, and you use the stem as a little antenna for transmitting a signal to a radio receiver underneath the vehicle. Now, and someone mentioned the strain gauge and stuff. Most of the optical stuff didn't work out. But a really cool technique that was developed by a university professor in Austria and is now being used by Siemens is to basically make a little chip, a surface acoustic wave transducer chip. And the idea is it's got a little antenna. You have a transmitter, it picks up radiation that's being transmitted, it converts it into a mechanical wave. This is what a surface acoustic wave device does. So it takes an electromagnetic and converts it into a strain wave that propagates down the crystal and comes, when it hits the end of the crystal, it comes back. Well, it turns out if you put it in the tire, it can flux
based upon the pressure. By flexing, it actually changes, for example, how much time it takes to go down and come back. Okay? It goes down, comes back with a variable delay time depending on the pressure. And what happens is, and this you should have learned in 309, but probably didn't, you have a wave going in that direction, you have a wave coming back in this direction. It goes from a mechanical to an electrical and re-radiates a signal. And in fact, if you're really, really cool, what you can do instead of just having a straight line path is you put little T's on it, and it can actually modulate the waveform coming back and put a digital ID code on it. This is the way passive RFIDs, radio frequency identification devices, work. By the way, some of those are similar techniques to what's used for the RF security devices when you walk out of stores with stuff that you didn't pay for or that the clerk didn't properly disable.
How does the disabling thing work for
me? Oh, it just blasts it usually with a bunch of RF and burns out the diode. The way a lot of these work is it's actually very cool. They have a transmitter at one frequency, okay? And you have a device very similar to this RFID. It picks up, it's a little antenna, picks it up, you've got a little tiny transmission line, and there's a diode at the end of the transmission line. What happens when you rectify a wave? Shades of 246. The spectrum changes considerably. It creates, and since the diode is a highly nonlinear device, it creates harmonics and other modulated frequencies that didn't exist in the original. So what happens is it re-radiates a different frequency, and you have a very sensitive receiver there that's tuned to pick up the signal from the tag. How do you stop it? You just blow out the diode by overvoltaging it or giving it too much RF or something. You can learn all of this, by the way, by looking up patents. It's actually interesting. But that's how many of them work. You know, it's amazing how many things there are around you and you don't know how they work. But we used to have a course in how RF, or rather, how electrical stuff works, and no one ever signed up for it. So we've never bothered with it again. Anyway, I think we've probably done a good, reasonable exercise. You could do this formal brainstorming, by the way, for your senior project. And you can even turn in the papers with the project or whatever, to show you did a brainstorming, but sometimes just getting a six-pack will do just as well as sitting down at a table. The examples in Hornstein are actually to go out and watch a movie to get an idea. You know, the movie special effects people come up with great schemes. I mean, you saw technology in the James Bond movies typically 5 to 10 years before it came out. You know, so you can get good ideas for products anywhere. Then you have to figure out how to actually do it. Okay, but engineering can be a lot of fun. Okay, Wednesday, you've got a proposal due. For the moment, you'll email it, both of us. Is anyone planning on putting a lot of figures in their proposal? Most of yours should be pretty small. So just email it to both of us. We'll send out an email if we're going to do something different with a digital Dropbox. And what are our instructions? They're due at like 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock on Wednesday. Okay. And if you have any questions about your proposal or even anything we talked about today, let us know. We're happy to talk to you about it.